We all deserve some yay in our day. So say hello to Hello. Hello makes oral and personal care products that add wonder to your routine, like a toothpaste that makes brushing fun for kids. It's called Unicorn Sparkle Toothpaste. It tastes like rainbows and sunshine, works brilliantly, and it's fun. So it's pretty much magic. And for the adults, Hello Anti-Plaque and Whitening Toothpaste, which is just as good without the unicorns. Visit HelloProducts.com and let Hello add some everyday yay into your life.
At Designer Shoe Warehouse, we believe that shoes are an important part of, well,
everything. From first steps to first dates, from all-nighters to all-time personal bests.
From building pillow forts to building
a life. For all the big and small moments that make up your whole world, DSW is there. And we've got just the shoes. Find a shoe for every you from brands you love at brag-worthy prices at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Not all meals are created equal. For instance, breakfast has the spicy egg McMuffin for a limited time, and lunch doesn't. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Imagine this. You are sitting in a courtroom. The judge is deciding whether jurors should be allowed to hear that the accused, Brian Koberger, allegedly bought a K-bar-style knife, knife sheath, and a sharpener online months before the college students were found brutally stabbed to death in their home. That's where the recent Brian Koberger hearing started. We're going to break it all down for you. We're going to break down what came out in that multi-hour court hearing. Who benefited? Who did not? What it all means? So if you don't want to sit through the hours of testimony, just stick with us and we'll get you caught up on where everything is sitting in the case of Brian Koberger, at least for right now. Because as you know, when it comes to a trial, most of the important elements, the most important decisions are actually made before the jury is ever seated. And that is what this hearing was about. Some crucial, crucial decisions made today by Judge Hippler. And let's just say the stakes weren't subtle at all. This isn't some sidebar discussion about where the attorneys sit. The rulings will draw the lines of the battlefield when the trial begins in August. So, back to the knife. Prosecutors say that Koberger's Amazon account shows he clicked on and purchased items that look a lot like the kind of knife and sheath police believe were used in the murders. Not just any knife, but a K-bar. The kind of blade that's rugged, tactical, and well. I could do the commercial. Exactly the kind of thing you don't want showing up at a crime scene. The defense, of course, tried to block this from coming into trial because, you know, their argument, other people might have had access to his Amazon account, and it's a common household, they said. Family members could have been browsing, clicking, buying. Who's to say it was Brian? I know you are, but what am I? Well, the judge didn't buy it. He ruled that the evidence is coming in. The account was tied to Koberger. The purchases were made, and unless the defense can prove that, say, Brian's uncle Gary was the one shopping for military-style blades 8 months before the murders, the jury's going to hear about it. The prosecution even bringing in expert witnesses to explain the click trail. This is new. How those purchases were made and what it all means. Which means jurors won't just see the items bought, they'll be walked through how they were found in his digital footprint. What was all browsed before deciding on the K-bar knife? You can argue all day about who might have used the account, but that's something the defense will have to do in front of the jury, because that knife trail, it's in. Judge Hippler said, yeah, absolutely, this is coming into trial. From there, the court moved on to something even more emotionally charged, the 911 call. This is a call made hours after the murders by one of the surviving roommates. She'd just found her friends dead in their home. You can imagine the panic, the confusion, and trauma baked into every second of that recording. The defense pushed hard to keep it out. They argued it was hearsay, that it wasn't the direct voice of witnesses describing something they saw, but a jumbled chain of secondhand impressions from a young woman in shock. Why do you think she's in shock? Could she have been there in the house, heard what happened? Saw the guy? Big bushy eyebrows? Prosecutor said it qualifies under what's called the excited utterance rule. Basically, if someone in the heat of a terrifying moment, what they say can be taken as trustworthy enough to bypass the unusual hearsay limitations. The judge leaned their way. He said the call, in large part, would be allowed in. He didn't rubber stamp the whole thing, though. He's going to review specific parts for redaction. Stuff that might go beyond firsthand observations or veer too far into speculation or rumor. So the jury will likely hear the fear in that roommate's voice. They'll hear her trying to explain what happened as she knew it in real time. The phone that the friend got, if you heard this call, you know what I'm talking about, as he walks around and tries to shelter the women there from seeing what he just saw. It's not just about facts, it's about atmosphere. And if you're the prosecution, it helps humanize the chaos and trauma inside that house. If you're the defense, it's another hurdle to climb. Especially when you're humanizing people and victims, and your client doesn't seem to have all that much of human qualities to him. Then came the 3D model. Nothing flashy, nothing dramatic, just a tool. But in this kind of trial, a tool like that matters. The judge approved the use of 3D rendering of the crime scene, a model of the off-campus house where the murders occur. It's the kind of thing jurors can see, digest, and use to orient themselves as witnesses and expert talk about who was where and when. Because the house is gone. Best they got. Turns a verbal testimony into a visual map. And let's face it, nobody remembers floor plans off the top of their head. A physical or a digital model makes this whole thing tangible. Would have been better to have the actual house, but whatever happened, happened there. Let's shift from the visuals to vocabulary. You'd be surprised how much time courts spend deciding what people can and can't say. And this trial, absolutely no exception. The defense asked the judge to ban words like psychopath or sociopath from being thrown around at trial, not because anyone's calling Koberger those things in open court yet, but because they didn't want the risk of it happening. Those terms carry some baggage. They're heavy, emotional, loaded with assumptions. You hear psychopath, and your brain jumps straight to serial killer territory now, doesn't it? Well, maybe it should. Even if there's no diagnosis on record, the judge agreed, no psychopath, no sociopath. It's not a medical trial. And the risk of making the jury prejudice was too high. But when it came to the language around DNA, the judge didn't hand out any red pens. The defense had wanted to stop experts from using phrases like touch DNA or contact DNA, worried that it might sound more conclusive than it is, because here's the thing, touch DNA can come from a handshake, a sneeze, or brushing against a doorknob. It doesn't prove intent, it doesn't prove presence in a meaningful way without context. Still, the judge said, nope, he's not going to micromanage scientific lingo. He trusts jurors to understand what's being said as long as the experts explain it clearly. If touch DNA is mentioned, it's on the lawyers and witnesses to give it proper context. He even warned that banning technical terms could backfire and trigger a mistrial if someone used the wrong word on the stand. So in this courtroom, touch DNA is fair game. You just better know what you're talking about when you bring it up. The final debate of the day was more personal than legal. It had to do with Koberger's family. His parents and sister have been listed as possible witnesses by the prosecution, and that creates a bit of a dilemma. If you're a witness, you're supposed to stay out of the courtroom until after you testify. That way, if you're not, just won't be influenced by what other people say on the stand. It makes sense in theory, but in this case, it means Koberger's own family might not be allowed to attend the trial, at least not until they've testified. And if the prosecution never calls them, well, then they could be banned from the courtroom altogether. Not something that they really want to have happen. Not something I think anyone really wants to have happen, but if you're going to testify, that's the rules of testifying. And to no one's surprise, the defense of Koberger pushed back. They said Koberger relies heavily on his family for support. That being cut off from them in a courtroom where his life is on the line would be kind of punishment all of its own. The judge found middle ground. He suggested that if the prosecution intends to call Koberger's family members, they should do it early. Get their testimony done, and then allow them to stay for the rest of the trial. That way, the witness rule is respected. But so is the defendant's right to family support. And that's where the day wrapped. No shouting matches, no gotcha moments, just a careful drawing of lines, what the jury can hear, what they can't, what words are fair game, what visuals are allowed. These are the guardrails that will shape every testimony, every cross-examination, and every inch of this trial. As the courtroom cleared out, one thing became very clear. This isn't going to be a simple case of whodunit. It's going to be a courtroom chess match where every move, every word has been pre-negotiated down to the inch. And here's where things get a little more nuanced. Less about what can be shown in court and more about how both sides plan to play the long game. Because behind the headlines and the horror of the case scene, what unfolded in court was a high-stakes negotiation over narrative, over what kind of story the jury will be told, and just as importantly, who gets to tell it. At the heart of the battle is Brian Koberger's alibi, or more importantly, his team's attempt to present one without putting him on the witness stand. According to documents filed earlier, Koberger's claims that he was out driving around at night at the murders, alone, no specific destination, just out. He allegedly told his defense team he was stargazing in the early morning hours in the rural outskirts near Moscow. Not the strongest alibi ever floated in a courtroom, especially on a cloudy night that you can't see the stars, but an alibi, nonetheless, or maybe. The defense is trying to make that story stick using cell phone data. Basically, they want to show where Koberger's phone was pinging off towers during that time frame. If it shows movement away from the crime scene, they argue it supports a claim he wasn't at the King Road house when the murders occurred. But here's the hitch. Koberger's lawyers want to present this data without putting Koberger himself on the stand. They're not trying to get him to say, yeah, I was out driving and here's where I went. They just want to let the data do the talking. Prosecutors aren't thrilled with that approach. They say if Koberger wants to claim he was somewhere else, he should have to testify to that under oath. The cell data on its own can't explain why he was moving around or whether he was even the one carrying the phone. Phones can be left in cars. Phones can be dumped. Phones don't testify. And the state's position is pretty clear. An alibi without a person attached to it is just a theory. The judge didn't shut the door entirely on the defense strategy, but he made it clear. And this is big. If Koberger wants to tell the jury he was stargazing alone, well, then someone's going to have to say it out loud in that courtroom. And there's two options. It's either Brian Koberger himself, which would mean he takes the stand, or a credible third party who can explain and back up the story. And that's a bit of a corner for the defense, because unless they've got someone else to tie the narrative together, which they haven't provided yet, it may come down to whether Koberger is willing and able to testify on his own behalf. Which brings us to the other strategic piece of the hearing, how Koberger's autism diagnosis factors into the trial. His defense team brought this up not as a last-ditch effort, but as a central part of their legal posture. They're arguing that Koberger is on the autism spectrum, and that certain traits tied to his condition, like flat affect, lack of visible emotion, and intense eye contact, you know, all the things that make him creepy, could be badly misinterpreted by a juror or anyone who happens to interact with him in any shape or form. I mean, think about it. If someone sits through days of gut-wrenching testimony, doesn't flinch, doesn't cry, doesn't react in a way most people might expect, what does that look like to a jury? I would call it the truth. No empathy. The defense is concerned that Koberger's natural demeanor might be read as cold, calculated, or even remorseless. Well, it is what it is. They're not saying autism explains the crime because that would be both inaccurate and dangerous, but they are saying it might impact how Koberger is perceived in the courtroom. And if that perception leans negative, it could be used against him in a death penalty phase where jurors are asked to weigh aggravating and mitigating factors before deciding whether someone should live or die. So the defense asked the judge for a very specific ruling. They wanted to prevent the state from using Koberger's autism or traits associated with it as an aggravating factor. They argued that allowing prosecutors to point to his demeanor or his social differences as evidence of dangerousness would be unjust and misleading. The prosecution, for their part, said they had no plans to make Koberger's autism part of their death penalty argument. They were going to suggest that being on the spectrum made him more likely to commit a violent crime or that his social behavior should count against him, but they also weren't ready to give the defense carte blanche to turn every courtroom moment into a psychological explainer. The judge landed somewhere in the middle, but closer to the defense. He ruled that autism as a diagnosis or as a behavioral framework cannot be cited by the prosecution as an aggravating factor in a potential sentencing phase. That means if Koberger is convicted and the case moves into the penalty phase, the state won't be allowed to argue that his condition somehow makes him more deserving of the death penalty. It's a narrow ruling, but an important one, because in a capital case, the sentencing phase is its own separate trial in many ways. The jury hears new evidence. Both sides make their case again, this time not about guilt, but about whether the punishment should be life or death. And the lines about what jurors can consider are drawn in advance. This ruling removes one potentially volatile line from that list. But the defense did not stop there. They're still trying to take the death penalty off the table entirely, and they've gone after it from a different angle, this time discovery. If you're not familiar with this term, discovery is a process where both sides in the case share evidence. In theory, it's supposed to be fair and timely. The prosecution turns over what they've got, the defense does the same, and everyone gets to prepare. But according to Koberger's attorneys, the state didn't exactly play nice. They claim that just months before the trial, prosecutors dumped an overwhelming volume of materials on them, thousands of pages, lab reports, expert analysis, all of it landing late in the game. The defense called it for what they saw it as insurmountable. That's their word. They argue that being handed that much information so close to trial makes it impossible to adequately prepare, especially in a case where the stakes are literally life and death. And based on that, they filed a broader motion asking the court to strike the death penalty entirely. As of now, the judge hasn't ruled on that request. He's considering it, but the prosecution is still officially seeking the death penalty, and the case is moving forward as a capital trial. It's one of the biggest open questions still hanging in the air, whether this will end with a jury deciding between guilty and not guilty or between prison and execution. What's clear from this phase of the hearing is that the legal arguments are evolving. It's not just about evidence. It's about interpretation, framing, and psychology. It's about how a jury will process a defendant who may not behave the way they expect and how the rules of the court need to account for that. And those rules are still being shaped. Because while the judge made a few clear calls on the alibi, on the use of autism in sentencing, other issues remain in flux. Not everything was decided during this round. Some rulings are still coming. And some decisions may end up determining what the jury never gets to hear at all. Let's talk about what didn't happen in the courtroom on April 9th. Because sometimes the most important part of a hearing isn't what gets ruled on, it's what gets left hanging. And in this case, it left plenty. One of the most anticipated topics that didn't get a final ruling involved Dylan Mortensen, the surviving roommate. Her name has been part of the case narrative almost from the start, not because she was a suspect, but because she was in the house when it happened. And according to early reports, she came face to face with someone she didn't recognize in the hallway, a masked man dressed in black with, this detail is one that keeps getting repeated, bushy eyebrows. Now, in most cases, that might sound like a pretty flimsy description. It's vague. It's not a license plate number or a face. But in this case, the prosecution wants to connect it to a photo that was found on Koberger's phone. A selfie, allegedly taken just hours after the murders took place, which they believe showed what looks like, eyebrows and all, at the time. And it's that photo right there if you're watching us on YouTube. The defense naturally isn't eager to let that connection be made in front of a jury. They're pushing back on Mortensen's testimony being used as a kind of soft indication. Their argument is that she was under extreme stress, that she'd been drinking, and that memory under those conditions is unreliable. And that even if she did see someone, saying bushy eyebrows is so general that it's essentially meaningless. Like, guys, plenty of people have thick eyebrows. But here's the rub. It's not just the words bushy eyebrows floating in the air. It's that the state wants to show jurors that Koberger, hours after the murders, took a photo that they believe shows those same distinctive eyebrows. They're trying to create that digital link. Dylan says that she saw the trait. And here's what he looked at the time. Giving a thumbs up. In a shower. Or next to a shower. Which reminds me a lot of Psycho. Or American Psycho, because he's wearing a really weird white button-up shirt right up to the neck. The thumbs up. Ted Bundy. It's a lot of nods going on in that photo. Just like if Papa Roger is him. You know, the online guy who knew stuff about the case no one else did and happened to have a profile pic that looked like Brian Koberger. Before anyone knew who Brian Koberger was. And Elliot Roger being a big incel. One that these guys look up to like Jesus. Papa Roger. You know, the head guy. No one's gonna figure this out. F you, all of you. I'm smarter than everybody. I don't know what was going on in his head. I wonder if it was something like that. So far, Judge Hippler hasn't said whether that photo can be used or whether Mortensen's observation will make it into trial, both pieces being in limbo, waiting for a written ruling. And the stakes are significant. If Mortensen's testimony is allowed, it may serve as one of the few pieces of eyewitness information the jury hears. Not an identification exactly, but a moment of presence. A line that places someone in the house. And let's jurors connect that moment to the defendant sitting across the courtroom. Let's go back to the 911 call. We already know that the judge said most of it can come in under the excited utterance rule. Essentially, when someone is reacting in the moment of crisis, their statements are considered reliable enough to bypass just hearsay limits. But most isn't all. Judge Hippler indicated that he would still be reviewing specific parts of that call to determine whether anything should be redacted before it is played for the jury. And that's a delicate process because what's at stake isn't just what the caller said, it's how she said it, when she said it, and why. Emotional tone matters, so does context. Some parts of that call might include secondhand information, something the caller was told rather than saw directly. And in court, that's a line that matters. You can't testify to someone else's words unless a very specific exception allows it. So we're still waiting to find out exactly how much of that call the jury will hear. Will it be raw, unfiltered? Will sections be muted, transcribed, edited? We don't know yet. The judge hasn't issued that written ruling. But when it comes, it's going to shape not just the factual record, but the emotional one, too. Another ruling that hasn't landed yet deals with Koberger's alibi, specifically how or if the defense can present it in court. We heard the defense argue that Koberger was driving alone that night out in rural areas, stargazing. They want to use cell phone data to support that claim. What they didn't get, though, was a firm decision on the mechanics. Who can say it? How much detail can be included? What if Koberger doesn't testify? The judge gave a strong indication that if no third-party witness is available to introduce an alibi, then it might not come in unless Koberger takes the stand. But we're still waiting on a written ruling to clarify exactly what's allowed, and that matters because if the cell data can't be introduced without Koberger's testimony, the defense may have to make a choice they don't want to make. Put their client on the stand or expose him to cross-examination or keep the alibi out of the jury's reach entirely. Those kind of decisions aren't made lightly. In a capital case, every inch of courtroom strategy is measured twice, sometimes three times. So until that ruling is on paper, the defense won't know exactly what tools they have to work with. Now, a lot of things in this case we're still up in the air. One major point stayed steady. The trial timeline. No delays, no extensions, at least not yet. Jury selection is still scheduled to begin July 30th of this year, 2025. That's a day when the court starts bringing in hundreds of potential jurors to be questioned, screened, and ultimately narrowed down to a group that will hear the case. Opening statements are set for August 11th, and based on how much time the court has blocked off, this trial could run late into October, maybe even November. Yeah. A lot of time. It's a long haul. If you're starting at the end of July and you're going to go all the way up to almost the 3-year anniversary of the murders, right around Thanksgiving, that's a long haul. But considering the volume of evidence, the number of witnesses, and the gravity of the charges, it is not surprising. This is a first-degree murder case with four victims and a death penalty on the table. It was never going to be quick. And before all of that begins, there's still another session on deck. The court scheduled a second day of pretrial hearings for April 10th, and that's where... what's going to happen? Well, more rulings are expected. Some of the other issues carried over from April 9th will likely be addressed there. Others may be held for written decisions in the days or weeks ahead. But either way, the pretrial phase is far from over. So we're going to be having another one of these conversations on that date. So as of the end of April 9th, what we had was a partial roadmap A list of things the jury will see. Amazon purchases, 911 call audio, demonstrative evidence like the 3D, or demonstrative evidence like the 3D model of the crime scene. A list of things the jury won't hear. Emotional labels like psychopath. Attempts to use autism as an aggravating factor. And then there's everything in between. The pieces that haven't landed yet. The testimony that might or might not come in. That's still waiting for a green light. What will it be? What could it be? And those unanswered questions, they're more than legal technicalities. They'll determine how the jury understands this case, whether they hear a voice or see a face or connect a description to a photograph, whether they hear about a man driving alone under the stars, or whether that part of the story stays off the record. Those are the lines still waiting to be drawn, and when they're drawn, they'll shape the trial, not just in what the jury hears, but how they put those pieces together. What's your thoughts? What are you waiting to hear about? Let us know in the comments section on YouTube, if you're watching there. If you're listening to us on the podcast platforms, please do check out our YouTube channel, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. We have conversations about these things. And that's the big part, conversations. So if you are going to comment, and I love you too, you know, bring the conversation. You can't just make accusations out there and be like, this is crazy. He's innocent or he's guilty and have nothing to it. Like, engage. Give us some information. If you think he is innocent, I'd love to hear like legitimate arguments, because I haven't seen any of that yet, other than it's crooked cops and it's a conspiracy. And okay, you can say those words and you can believe that, but explain. Give me the data. Give me the information, because you can't make decisions just based on blatant words. I can say he's guilty. Well, okay, but why do I feel that? I should give you that information. If you can say he's innocent, okay, great. Why? And just crooked cop conspiracy. That doesn't cut it. It may cut it with your friends that aren't all that bright. But if you want to argue this, then bring it. Tell us why. Give us the details of what you're thinking. That seems to be the part half the time that is missing out there in the comments. It's like, okay, great. Why? Why? So I encourage you to comment. I encourage you to express your opinion either way, with context. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're downloading podcasts. You don't miss any of this case and all the cases that we cover for you right here at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. My name is Tony Bruschi. Thank you for joining us.
Want true crime coverage all day, every day? Press subscribe now to the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today and get the latest cases delivered right to your feed. He was charming, handsome, a devoted husband, a doting father. When his wife died tragically in a freak accident, everyone pitied him. He played the role so well, grieving widower, devastated, single dad, just trying to put the pieces back together. But the thing about perfect men, they're usually hiding something. And this one was hiding everything. The affair, the insurance policy, the other wife in another state who had no idea she was married to a walking crime scene. If she had only subscribed to True Crime Today, Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, she could have listened to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi ad-free. And before everyone else, she could have seen through the lies. She could have gotten out while she still had the chance. Instead, she's just another case we'll be covering next week. Don't be her. Subscribe now to True Crime Today, Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Hey guys, it's Erin Andrews from Calm Down with Erin and Carissa. They say you can't plan for the unexpected, but they probably haven't heard of Aflac. You know them as the famous duck, but Aflac is a leader in supplemental insurance. They can better prepare you for life's surprises by helping cover expenses your health insurance doesn't. Even with good health insurance, medical bills are no joke. Many people don't realize health insurance wasn't designed to cover everything, which means money set aside for essentials like rent goes towards unexpected medical bills instead. That's where Aflac comes in. They pay cash that can be used for anything you choose. Think copays, deductibles, and even non-medical expenses like gas or groceries. Without Aflac, if you're sick or injured, gaps in your coverage can come back to haunt you. With Aflac, you can better protect yourself against the unexpected and help provide you and your family with financial security and added peace of mind. You can't predict the future, but you can better prepare for it with Aflac. Get help with expenses health insurance doesn't cover. Visit aflac.com to learn more.
There's a time and a place for Filet-O-Fish, but breakfast is for sausage biscuits. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Dutch Boy's Durafighter Interior Paint is a paint and primer in one with a tough, lasting formula. It provides great scrub resistance and durability with remarkable hide and a smooth finish. Say big on Dutch Boy's Durafighter Paint and start your next project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money
at Menards. You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to lifelock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.